On behalf of myself and on behalf of my country, to you and all African Americans, from the beginning of our nation's history, in honor of your ancestors and on behalf of your children, please hear this from my heart. I apologize. Please forgive us.
That's Marianne Williamson during her so-called Love America tour last year. She had the white members of her audience hold hands with the black audience members as she guided them in an apology. Williamson is a New York Times bestselling author, motivational speaker, and former spiritual advisor to Oprah Winfrey. In 2014, she ran as an independent for Congress representing the West Side of L.A. Ted Lieu won that race. Widely seen as a long-shot candidate, her recent performance at the debates caught a lot of people's attention. She was the most Googled candidate during the debate. And in New Hampshire, polls show her ahead of Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, and Kirsten Gillibrand, although overall she has little support compared to the frontrunners. As part of our series of interviews with the 2020 Democratic contenders, I spoke with Marianne Williamson earlier today. Marianne Williamson, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I understand you used to live in Los Angeles and now live in Iowa full time. Is that correct?
Well, yes. I've lived most of my adult life, actually, in Los Angeles.
By moving to Iowa, the significance there is you are planting your flag for the Iowa caucuses next year.
No, I would not. Well, yes and no. I was living in New York City for the last couple of years. And when my apartment lease came up, New York is pretty much outside the, you know, that's not where you are. It's sort of outside the pale for the traveling that you do during a campaign. So I decided instead to set down my furniture in one of the primary states where I would be a lot. And Des Moines is lovely. And obviously I was extremely important. So I don't think that my focus on Iowa is any more than any other presidential candidate. It is the first caucus state. So anybody running for president is focused on Iowa. It has no greater significance than that.
Okay. Well, California is also very important in this
election.
It
sure is. It absolutely is. And that's why I'm here quite a bit. But I was here, you know, I was here even in the last couple of years. I would come here every month to work. So Los Angeles is, California is a kind of home base for me no matter what.
During the Democratic debate back in June, you surprised some people by saying you would defeat Donald Trump by harnessing love. What do you mean by that?
I think the president has clearly harnessed some of the worst aspects of human character for political purposes: racism, bigotry, homophobia, xenophobia. He has harnessed these emotions. You know, clearly, when you look at something like terrorism, when you look at Nazism, these are human emotions of hatred that become harnessed and turned into political force. But I think dignity and decency and love and mercy and justice can be harnessed for political force as well. When I visited Homestead Detention Center a couple of weeks ago, I saw something very interesting. Not only am I, like millions of other people, very concerned about what's happening inside those detainment camps, I was also very moved by the people who show up at the camps day in and day out in that Miami heat just to bear witness to what is going on. And that is also a very important aspect of the American character, the idea that people do care, the fact that people are morally outraged by so much of what is going on today, including things at our southern border. I see in America, I had read an interview where Jared Kushner said that during the campaign, he had said to his father-in-law, there are a lot of angry people out there. We could harness that. And I have felt I see a lot of really good, decent, wonderful people out there, and we can harness that and change the world. Hate inspires action, but love inspires action as well.
Okay, so specifically, what kind of action would you take when it comes to immigration? Would you decriminalize illegal immigration?
The issue of actually the word decriminalization is is not something that is that simple to say. This is what I believe. I believe that the immigrant experience is part of the narrative, the story of America. All four of my grandparents came here through Ellis Island, escaping pogroms in Russia. We have a situation where the president has demonized immigrants. Seeking asylum is not a crime. Seeking asylum is a statutory right. It is the president now seeking to criminalize something that was in fact not criminal before. It is the president who has squeezed so many people into a smaller number of ports of entry when there used to be more. So obviously we need judges, obviously we need more agents, obviously we need more technology. But I think most Americans don't realize Ronald Reagan gave amnesty to 8 million people. And before 1973, all that an undocumented worker had to do was to go to a registry office. We have a humanitarian crisis, and it starts way before the border. The humanitarian crisis in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Guatemala, that is so great that it is leading people, in order to escape the horror and the violence that they face every single day, to actually walk across a desert with small children. That is where we should be focused. We should be focused, and this goes back into love. Who have we become that we are not would not concern ourselves with the humanitarian crisis? This is what America is.
But you mentioned Ronald Reagan granting amnesty. Would you grant amnesty to the estimated 10-plus million undocumented immigrants now living in the United States?
What I believe we need to do is to provide a path for citizenship, a path to citizenship to everyone who obviously has not committed a crime. We obviously do not want criminals. We do not want violent criminals, whether they were born here or from anywhere else. So, but beyond that, yes, it's time to just put this behind us, to provide a reasonable path to citizenship for undocumented workers. Otherwise, what are we going to do? Are we going to have mass deportation rates and go into some horrifying scenario? Where that I don't see that as a reasonable option, and certainly not an option that is in keeping with American values.
I want to talk about the word miracle, miracles. It's a word that you use a lot. It's figured prominently in your career. You've written a couple of books with that word in the title, A Year of Miracles, The Age of Miracles. You teach and lecture based on the book, A Course on Miracles. And your stated purpose in life is to create miracles. So what miracles would you perform in the White House?
A miracle is defined the way I use the word. And remember, I'm a faith leader. That's what I've been doing for 35 years. A miracle is a shift in the way we think. That's how a miracle is defined in all of my books and all of my work. A miracle is a shift in thinking from fear to love. So that is exactly the miracle that belongs everywhere, whether it is in politics or anywhere else, and is very relevant to the topics we're talking about today, such as immigration, that we can face the world through a filter of fear, hatred. We can also face the world through a filter of love. That is the choice that every human being in every moment faces. Whether it was Gandhi, whether it was Martin Luther King Jr., the idea of saying that there is a force of love inside all of us that can that propels us into our political action as well as every other aspect of our lives. This is not new. It's not woo-woo. It's not wacky. It's part of great political and philosophical traditions for centuries.
But also what is a tradition in our country and is a bedrock principle in our country is the separation of church and state. So why should voters have somebody who sells herself as a spiritual leader and a faith leader, as you just called yourself, why should voters put that person in charge of running the country?
Well, first of all, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that I used the word miracle quite a bit in my career. You've actually not heard me use the word miracle at all in this political campaign. I have great respect for the separation of church and state. It is, in fact, one of the most enlightened aspects of our Constitution, and it has a dual function. One aspect of it is to protect our governmental functioning from any interference by religious authorities, and it also means that no one having a service at a church or a mosque or a synagogue or even a young atheist meeting, let's say, is going to have a governmental authority coming in and saying this is shut down because it's not on our official list. People are free in the United States to believe or not to believe. I respect that deeply. And I also respect, remember, I'm a Jew, so I myself am not from a from the majority religion. So I very much respect the fact that we in our political conversation have a secularized tradition. I am not having a religious conversation with people in this campaign, and there is no language that I'm using that would say otherwise. I am not having a religious conversation as part of my political campaign. I'm not doing it as a candidate, and I would not do it as a president either.
Now, you have said that the standard politicians, the standard way of doing business, the standard politics are basically not working for this country, and that you as an outsider candidate would have a fresh approach. We have heard that from the current occupant of the White House. In fact, there are other similarities that you share with President Trump. You're both entrepreneurs with no experience in government, and you run in celebrity circles. You speak off the cuff, and you promote this outsider status, and also that experience in some cases, you have said on your website and elsewhere, is basically an albatross because it limits people's imagination to come up with novel solutions to problems. So how are you not sort of the Democratic version of President Trump?
First of all, I did not say that someone's experience is an albatross. That is not what I said. What I have said is that there are different kinds of experience. And I have pointed out that very experienced politicians led us into Iraq war. So I have said that a certain kind of political experience is not a guarantee of vision. It is not a guarantee of moral certitude. It is not a guarantee that someone is actually paving the best road for our future. And Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, said that the administrative aspect of the job is secondary, that the most important part of the job is moral leadership. And I believe that when we're talking about qualifications and experience, for that matter, for the presidency, particularly at this time, there is a level of vision. Yes, there is a level of leadership skill that has to do with harnessing imagination and inspiration that is also extremely important. There is nothing in our Constitution that says someone has to have been an elected official. The founders left it to every generation to determine the skill set that that generation feels is most necessary to navigate the times in which we live.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I'm wondering, though, after 4 years of President Trump, do you worry that people are fatigued with someone who has little direct experience with running the government?
The profundity of American democracy, and this is what I respect about American democracy, is that the power to make these decisions lies in the hands of the people. So no, I don't worry. I find voters very intelligent. Voters are very smart. And they, in my experience, they appreciate someone talking about the things that matter most, and they realize the game by which they are lured away from the deeper conversations by what is ultimately a more superficial one that dominates American politics today.
All right. Marianne Williamson, author and Democratic candidate for president, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, while we've been focusing on the amnesty rule President Trump issued this week, his administration issued another rule that hasn't received as much attention. The Health and Human Services Department has told clinics like Planned Parenthood that if they want to continue to receive federal funds, they cannot refer their patients for abortions. And so Planned Parenthood says it will forego federal funding. Meanwhile, its president was forced to resign yesterday. Unclear if that's related. Here to give us the details is Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, so let's talk about Dr. Liana Nguyen leaving Planned Parenthood. She says she was removed due to philosophical differences. What are those differences?
Well, what we are told is that she's a doctor. She's the former health commissioner in the city of Baltimore. And she really wanted to treat abortion as routine health care, as part of the suite of services that Planned Parenthood offers. I think the rest of Planned Parenthood and apparently the board at Planned Parenthood wanted her to be a little bit more political than she was. This has been sort of a political campaign to try and defund Planned Parenthood, of which this regulation is. is one of the first really successful pieces so far. But there have also been indications that it had as much to do with her management style and her lack of management experience as it did with these philosophical differences between where she was going and where the board wanted to go.
Hmm. All right. But BuzzFeed did report a few months ago that some top political officers left the group amid those concerns that she was trying to depoliticize Planned Parenthood. Is that something that is an internal tension within the organization, how political to get?
Yes, and it always has been. It's important to remember that Planned Parenthood is sort of divided into two different entities, of which its president is head of both. There's the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, which is what oversees the Planned Parenthood affiliates, and then there's the Planned Parenthood Action Fund, which is actually their political arm. And so it is there has always been this kind of separation between running the clinics and advocating for women's reproductive health. But sort of built into the culture of the place is obviously a feeling that even the clinics themselves, obviously the clinics themselves have been under siege politically, and they have been. I've been covering abortion since the late 1980s, and one of the very first stories I did was about efforts to defund Planned Parenthood. So this is nothing new. It's ebbed and flowed over the years, but Planned Parenthood has always been under political assault because it's seen as a symbol for anti-abortion activists as a place that provides abortions, which mm-hmm. it largely is.
Right. And it receives about $130 million. Is that right for this?
Yes. Now, Planned Parenthood gets two different streams of federal funding. This is the federal funding that it gets through Title X. That's the Federal Family Planning Program that has banned abortion since its inception because it was passed in 1970, signed by Richard Nixon, sponsored by George H.W. Bush when he was a member of the House, pre-Roe v. Wade. So Title X has never paid for abortion. Planned Parenthood also gets money from Medicaid. In fact, they get many more federal dollars from the Medicaid program. Again, they cannot get federal funding for abortion because of the Hyde Amendment that mm-hmm. bans most federal funding of abortion through Medicaid. So for the moment, Planned Parenthood said it will stop taking the Title X funding because these new rules prohibit doctors from providing abortion referrals, which Planned Parenthood says not providing abortion referrals for women who want them would be unethical. But they are still, as of this moment, at least accepting Medicaid funding from the federal government.
Okay, so what does that actually mean, not providing abortion referrals? Does it mean you can't talk about abortion at all with your patients?
Well, there was an earlier version of these rules in the Reagan administration that took effect for about 4 weeks at one point in 1992. Those would have prohibited any mention of abortion. These rules are not quite that draconian. They say that health professionals, and it's not always doctors, it can be nurses or counselors, can give patients what's called non-directive counseling. So if you have an unintended pregnancy, you're presented with all your options. But if upon hearing their options, the pregnant woman says, I would like an abortion, then they would not be permitted to tell the women where they could go to get them.
Even though it could be there. Right there.
Even though it could be there. Well, another piece of this rule that doesn't take effect for a year would require that Title X clinics and abortion providing facilities be physically and financially separate, but obviously physically separate, so that if Planned Parenthood wanted to stay in the Title X program, they would have to physically separate from the parts of their entity that provides abortion. I should point out at this moment that not every Planned Parenthood provides abortion. In fact, I think it's only about half of them. So there are a large number of Planned Parenthoods that don't actually do abortions. It would refer women somewhere else. They could no longer refer the women somewhere else.
Okay, so they're saying we're not going to do this, so we won't take the money. There are other clinics, though, that are affected by this who may not be in such a position to say no to the federal funds, smaller clinics.
That's right. There absolutely are. We've seen a couple of other clinics. This only really went into effect on Monday, so it's all rather new. It's been confusing. The regulations were stayed by a court, and then the stay was lifted, and then it was reimposed, and now it's been lifted again. So nobody was quite sure what the timing of this was going to be. But Planned Parenthood says it has stopped taking the federal funds, and it has stockpiled some emergency funding and hopes to raise more from donors to allow them to keep their doors open. But as you mentioned, Planned Parenthood is not the entire Title X program. There are many other clinics, some of them independent, some of them government-run, that may have difficulty without, will have to make this decision. Can they continue to provide services, or will they have to stop taking federal funding for Title X also?
And meanwhile, there's this lawsuit going forward that is challenging this entire rule, right?
That's right. It's in the Ninth Circuit. A three-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit actually upheld the rule, said that it was likely that the government would prevail. The entire Ninth Circuit is now going to consider the case, and that they were the ones that put the injunction on the rules back into effect, but then lifted it again late last week. So the court is however going to take up this issue on bank. After that decision, it could go to the Supreme Court.
Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Coming up, Big Sur, a victim of its own beauty. Tourists are crowding the former hippie haven. Hashtag stay home. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Big Sur, once a haven for artists and drifters seeking peace and serenity. Now, the next destination in our summer series, hashtag stay home, places overwhelmed by summer tourists.
This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
If you want fun, then listen to this. New York's hottest club is Slice.
I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something.
Are we there yet?
Well, some residents of Big Sur, the gorgeous coastal community in Northern California, are urging tourists to stay away. Over the July 4th weekend, locals hung a giant banner off Big Sur's Bixby Creek Bridge that read, "Overtourism is killing Big Sur," in all caps. That bridge has drawn fans of the TV show Big Little Lies. The bridge is in the opening credits, and now it's in a gazillion Instagram photos. Speaking of, some people are fighting back in an Instagram account called Big Sur Educates You, with pictures of tourists blocking roadways, trampling plants, feeding wildlife. Well, joining us to talk about this is Big Sur local Magnus Torin. He is the executive director of the Henry Miller Memorial Library in Big Sur. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Well, what's it like this summer for you with the tourism?
You know, when I hear the intro and I hear you speak of this, there are so many thoughts that run through my mind when I hear this and I get this question. Overall, traffic has increased onto the two-lane highway in Big Sur. Anecdotally, there's no question about it that it's increased. The fact that we are standing in line, that people who come to visit Big Sur are unable to get into turnouts to enjoy the view. They have to wait to get a parking lot at various restaurants and so on. So it's a real problem.
I guess I'm just wondering, there was some pent-up demand for Big Sur because of the road closure that lasted, almost a year. So people couldn't really get to Big Sur from the south. And I'm wondering if that's what we're seeing as well. People will say, oh, Big Sur is open now. Let's go see it.
Absolutely. And Big Sur has the blessing, of course, that has always been in Big Sur's favor, is that it is inaccessible. It is tough to access Big Sur. And we have a two-lane highway. So we are going to have gridlock. Imagine if it happens during a fire and you have a gridlock on Highway 1. that's when everybody's really going to sit up straight in their chairs and say, we should have thought about this. And I think people are more and more thinking in those along those lines.
Well, what are they thinking about? Creating another road or widening that two-lane highway?
Nope. See, that's not that we cannot widen it. There is no. It's physically impossible or physically extremely expensive to even consider widening it. And also, it would be against. It would also be against the preservation ethic, the whole idea of Big Sur as being a place that is wild and rural in its character. And the thoughts that are being put onto the table include, you know, eventually maybe having some kind of reservation system. In the digital age, maybe that can be done without having to, you know, the price of visit be the determining factor. But you know, you make your reservations. There are a few places like that around the world where that has been implemented.
You mean reserve actually driving that stretch of highway?
I know. But I mean, you know, I'm just saying that these are thoughts that have been laid out on the table, and some idea is going to have to come along, because if we are allowing an increase in traffic each and every year, then it's a mathematical axiomatic statement, right? We are going to have gridlock on the highway.
The locals, as we are discussing, have been very outspoken about their frustration with the tourists. And there's something called the Big Sur Pledge that locals have asked visitors to consider. What is that?
Well, the Big Sur Pledge is essentially a scream from the heart, I guess, where we are trying, and somewhat in vain, I'm sure, to just appeal to people's good sense and when they come to a place, that they respect the fragility of Big Sur, that they respect the regulations that are there, that we treat the place with respect and we leave no trace. And that's what the pledge really is about.
And can you just talk about road etiquette? Like, you're talking about this long line of cars snaking up and down Highway 1 around Big Sur, and then people kind of stop and pull over. And is there something that drivers should do to drive better and to respect the other drivers and ensure that there's some kind of civility?
Right. No, I think yes. And I think that's already written basically in the laws of traffic as they are. I mean, you will get a fine from a CHP officer if you're driving the road at 20 miles an hour with 17 cars behind you. You will get a fine if you park in the middle of the highway, or if you park even, you know, 3 feet inside of the white line. And having your family get out of the car and stand there on the side of the road, like as if this is some sort of gravel road somewhere out in nowhere, and you're taking pictures. These are the kinds of stories you hear all the time. And it is tough. I mean, I never myself feel like blaming the visitor, obviously. It's not their fault that they fall in love with this beautiful place. And it's not their fault that they want to take a picture. It is their fault that they are not sensitive enough to understand that this highway is actually a two-lane highway with a lot of other vehicles on it.
So, Magnus, is winter a lot better in Big Sur? Is it a totally different vibe?
I hesitate to say that, but that may be, again, with the help of social media, perhaps it will be helped by the fact that we can now communicate with one another sort of instantly. And there may be a system where information is being disseminated regarding the traffic situation, and people will be then dissuaded from coming at the peak hours. Those times when the highway is free of traffic, they are the favorite times for people who live here or people who are privileged enough to come down or, you know, hike the trail. Those times are beautiful, and again, that's sort of symbol of what Big Sur tries to preserve.
Magnus Torin, Executive Director of the Henry Miller Memorial Library. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, whatever you call them, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, the alt-right, they're emboldened now.
Misogyny, homophobia. are integral to the rise of white nationalism and, you know, extremism and radicalization that we've seen in American society.
A new book tracks the rise of this movement. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Birtherism is racist. Saying a Mexican judge can't be fair because of his heritage is racist. Saying immigrants from Mexico are rapists is racist. Saying there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville is racist. Calling African countries whole countries is racist. And telling four members of this body to go home is racist.
California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell reading a list of President Trump's comments, tweets, and conspiracy theories on the House floor yesterday. He, along with the rest of his Democratic colleagues in the House, then voted to condemn the president's recent remarks about the four congresswomen as racist. Trump's opponents see a direct link between what he says and an increase in white supremacist or alt-right activity here in the U.S. Well, what exactly is the alt-right these days? How fringy is it? And how much does the movement influence this administration? Alexandra Minna Stern has researched that for her new book. It's called Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Well, let's first talk about our terms here, because as I indicated, there are lots of different descriptions for overlapping ideologies, similar ideologies. And I'm just wondering how you define it.
The term alt-right has been around for about 10 years, and it became kind of a trendy catch-all phrase for what today many of those involved in this movement call themselves, which is the dissident right. They've kind of abandoned the term alternative right because it became so associated with Charlottesville. But I think it's still a useful term because it captures the kind of umbrella nature of the different aspects of the dimensions of those who consider themselves dissidents or white nationalists or men's rights advocates or the whole bundle of beliefs and people that fall under this broad category.
Well, it's interesting that you said white nationalists and men's rights and all these people come under the same umbrella, but I wonder if they would consider themselves all part of the same, because even the founder of the Proud Boys, Gavin McInnes, the founder of Vice Media, he's tried to distance himself from this whole movement post-Charlottesville. So how do the leaders of these groups now see themselves?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say, on the one hand, they're doing a lot of rhetorical work, trying to define themselves in the most positive terms possible for their constituents, and often seeking to distinguish themselves from, let's say, you know, Nazis or neo-Nazis or, you know, hardcore racists. And that's definitely the case with the Proud Boys, which is first and foremost, a misogynistic and self-described chauvinistic organization. However, you can't just take how they describe themselves at face value. You have to look at what their messages are and who they associate with and what kinds of things they actually do, both online and out there in the real world.
Right. And so we saw them here in Los Angeles engaging in these brawls, and they're kind of described as sort of like a bunch of guys who like to go out drinking and brawling in that way. But you're seeing there's something more sinister to that they actually are seeking some kind of change in the culture and society and in America.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that one of the reasons why Proud Boys is in the title to my book is that I think that the misogynistic aspect and the sexism aspect of the alt-right is absolutely essential to its existence. So it's important not to trivialize it, not to underplay it, but to look at the ways in which misogyny, homophobia, and to some extent, and definitely transphobia to a great extent, are integral to the rise of white nationalism and, you know, the kind of, you know, extremism and radicalization that we've seen in American society over the past, you know, 5 or 10 years.
But misogyny and chauvinism and racism, that is certainly not new. It's been around for a very, very long time. Why do you say in the last 5 to 10 years?
Well, I would say those elements have been around for a long time. I think there's a few aspects of what's going on right now that make it distinct. The first is just the way in which these groups were able to connect with each other and to catalyze and propagate, you know, what are really kind of neo-fascist ideas in the context of social media. There's been a clampdown on some of that, but they're really, these networks have been established, and even if they're somewhat ephemeral, even if some of them are shut down, they exist and they play a role in political discourse. And the second thing is that, you know, the Proud Boys and, you know, other movements that we've seen, groups like the American Identity Movement, which are overwhelmingly male and seek to bring European-style identitarianism to the United States. These movements are happening in the context of the rise of national populism across the globe and the increasing rise of authoritarianism. So I think it's really important to put this in a broader global context and to think about these movements, which some people, you know, like to kind of just relegate to the fringe or relegate to kind of extremism that won't have that much of an impact on American society. You know, kind of to relegate them just to something we don't have to think about or we don't have to worry about too much. But I would say that we should be very concerned at this particular moment, and we should really be aware of not just like who the people are and what the names of the groups are, but the particular ideas that they're propagating and the language that they're using.
So white nationalism is something that it envisions a white nationalist state. So does it think that America can go back to being majority white?
Well, supporters of, you know, white nationalists want America or a portion of America to go back to being, you know, circa 1960, when almost 90% of Americans would have checked that Caucasian or white box on the census. So that is really kind of the heyday for them and the ideal return point. One of the things that's interesting about white nationalism is that white nationalists like to view themselves more benevolently, you know, as compared to white supremacists, because, you know, they like this idea of, quote, human biodiversity, end quote. What that sounds kind of appealing, you know, when you first hear it, but what it actually means is that each race has its own place. You know, each species should have, you know, its own habitat. Therefore, each race should have its own ethnostate. And if that type of human biodiversity can just be imposed, then every racial group will be happier, healthier, and more able to fend for its own. Now, of course, underlying that is, you know, it's shot through with ideas of white superiority in every way, shape, or form, and the idea of creating, you know, an at least 90% white territory in the United States, often imagined to exist in the Pacific Northwest, and relegating, you know, African Americans to the South, sending most Jews back to Israel or maybe somewhere in the Northeast. Latinos, Mexican Americans could go back to the Southwest. It's unclear where Asians would go. And it's unclear where all the where all the whites who didn't want to participate would go. You know, they would go to some alternative zone, but they wouldn't really be permitted in the white ethnostate.
So well, this is all absurd, right? I mean, that's not obviously going to happen. So what do they think could happen in reality?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think in reality, they want to start local. There's a big focus, on looking at local politics and trying to infiltrate local politics. And, you know, it is interesting to think that white nationalists really like to focus on the Pacific Northwest as their ideal territory. And the Pacific Northwest, you know, is a region that is predominantly white still, particularly if you compare it to Texas and California and other parts of the Southwest. You know, I think that this is another instance where it's easy to dismiss this and say, well, this is a totally fringe idea. It's totally undoable. In fact, it's laughable. It's so absurd. But then I think we need to look at, well, what are the actual insidious proposals that are part of this? And what it is, it's about, you know, reintroducing racial segregation, supporting ideas of biological or essential racial difference, stoking fears about demographic change, and basically, you know, supporting boundary lines in American society and really highlighting differences in a way that can be subtle but can be very violent.
And so are you seeing echoes of that in what's happening on the border with our immigration fight over the citizenship question on the census?
Yeah, I mean, that's again why I like to think of this book as not meant to be a focus on particular people or particular organizations, but what are the ideas that have been unleashed and that are taking their toll on American society? So, you know, it is pretty shocking to think that we're living at a time when kind of white tribalism is ascendant, at least among a minority of the population, and we have tens of thousands of people in detention centers on the U.S.-Mexico border. That is not a coincidence. Now, I don't have all of the intellectual insights to connect all of the dots between those, but, you know, this has to do with our political environment, with the kind of discourse that's out there. I'm not trying to say, like, Trump is a white nationalist, Trump is a fascist. That's not my point. What I'm really interested in is, why do these ideas have traction? How are they being rolled into politics? How are they being rolled into culture? And what kind of a toll are they taking on American society, particularly the most vulnerable, particularly people of color, particularly transgender or non-binary people? So there are people who are being victimized discursively and also physically, you know, and in their day-to-day lives by this new form of politics. And this new form of politics is informed by white nationalist thought, or broadly speaking, alt-right thought. And it's not that it, you know, 5 years from now, maybe this will have been a blip in time. Maybe we'll look back on this and say, well, America really lost its way for those few years. But, you know, it's also possible that these ideas will infiltrate themselves, you know, more powerfully, at least, you know, and this is a big country, so they can play out more powerfully in some regions, you know, than others. And from California, you know, you might not necessarily feel this as much, you know, living in Los Angeles or Santa Monica, but you might feel this more in other parts of the country. So there is a differential aspect to it as well.
The book is called Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination by Alexandra Minna Stern. Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, joining me in the studio now is Jared Hill, filling in for Steve Chiotakis today in Greater LA at 1 o'clock. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, great. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What's on the show today?
We've got a lot coming up on the show. The big thing we're talking about today is a new survey that just came out polling black voters here in LA and seeing what those issues are that are the most important to them. And there's some surprising findings. You would think Donald Trump and immigration being such top headlines in the news every day would be in there. And they're both at the bottom of the list.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
is interesting. And then do we find out who they want to vote for in
yes.
2020?
Yes. Well, what was interesting is this survey was done before the first Democratic debate. So Joe Biden did pretty well in there. Kamala Harris did as well. But all of the polling that's come after that has said that those two things have swapped. So that was also interesting.
All right. Well, for more details, check it out at 1 o'clock, Greater LA. Jared Hill, thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, have a hankering for a mangosteen? Go online to the crafty site Etsy. If you have no idea what I just said, stick around. All will be explained next on Press Play.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Etsy, the online marketplace for all things crafty, often veering into crafty preciousness, is also apparently a great place to buy fruit, mangosteens, rambutans, even guava. When you can't find it at your local grocery store, you can buy these fruits on Etsy. Lillian Min is a freelance journalist and wrote about Etsy's underground produce market for Eater. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so you actually stumbled upon this while you were on the hunt for a mangosteen. So first of all, what is a mangosteen?
A mangosteen is a fruit that looks like it came out of a cartoon. It's a tropical fruit native to Southeast Asia, about the size of your fist normally, and it's dark purple, and it has a hard shell, but when you cut it open, its fruit actually looks like garlic cloves, and it has a kind of vanilla taste to it, and it's known as a delicacy within Asia. And it's super, super seasonal, so it's hard to get even at the epicenter, I guess, of the mangosteen crop, and it is much, much harder to get outside of that region.
But you found it on Etsy.
I did.
So, I mean, why Etsy?
Well, it was something that I didn't actively seek out on my own. There's a specialty grocery store near where I live in Northern California called Berkeley Bowl. And I noticed last summer that they had a single bucket of mangosteen in their huge, huge produce section. And I flipped out when I was in the store. And it wasn't until this summer rolled around when I mentioned to my partner, like, man, it was so fortuitous that we found mangosteen last summer. Like, I wonder if Berkeley Bowl will have it again. And he said that he had actually done some digging and he had found some listings for the fruit on Etsy. And I was pretty shocked to learn that. And so I went to go check it out. And sure enough, there are pounds of fruit, of mangosteen fruit, being sold on Etsy.
Who is selling the mangosteens on Etsy?
So there are two primary storefronts that I found on Etsy. And these are folks that also sell other types of tropical fruit, including the kinds that you mentioned before. And the two stands that I checked out, one was called Great Plentiful Shop, and it's based in California. And the other one is called Fresh Florida Fruit, and it is based out of Homestead, Florida. And as far as I know, there haven't been any other people listing pounds of mangosteen in the way that these two storefronts do.
You can't get it on Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon, but part of the reason that I specifically went to Etsy is because the people leaving reviews there are really, really thorough. So on Amazon, it's like, at this point, I take all of the reviews with a healthy grain of salt. But then with Etsy, the people that are posting about it are like sending in photos. They're writing like long like anecdotes about every nuance of the fruit when they received it. And I just found myself gravitating more toward that kind of certainty, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It seemed more authentic. It seems like you're actually going to get a mangosteen or that's ripe that you can eat.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it expensive?
It is not cheap. For both of those listings, the price for a couple pounds of fruit is between $50 and $80. And the price apparently fluctuates seasonally because when I first bought the fruit and then the listings that they have now, they're actually different prices. Not by too much, like maybe $10, but it's not insignificant either for fruit.
So you want to make sure you're getting a good piece of fruit.
You absolutely do, yes.
Okay, so it is still surprising that Etsy is associated mainly with crafty stuff and you can buy food on it. Anything else you can buy on Etsy that you wouldn't suspect?
Oh, man. Well, I use Etsy for all sorts of like super niche purchases. So if I ever need a customized anything, Etsy is the first place I look. But in terms of other stuff, I would say that the houseplant market there has really boomed. And there's a really popular houseplant right now called a Pilea, and the second name of it is extremely long and difficult to say. And it has these like little circular leaves, and it looks really cute. And the distinction I make is that it was something that you could not find in U.S. nurseries, or it was this long, drawn-out process. And before it became like an Instagram famous houseplant, basically, you could buy cuttings from Canadian people selling it on Etsy.
Really?
Yeah, that's how I got mine. Before they became like something that people actively sought out in the way that you would a Monstera or something.
Right. Okay, so the Chinese money plant and all sorts of crazy tropical fruit on Etsy.
Yeah.
And then maybe some hand-knit teapot cover cozy or something.
Yeah, something I guess that like, I guess the thing that clicked for me is like, okay, Etsy is like a marketplace for like specialists who are not amateurs. And the people selling on Etsy have like legitimate fruit import export businesses on their own. So it's like, okay, Etsy and fruit is not actually the weirdest thing that you can imagine. But it's still pretty weird, and that's what got me to look into it.
Still pretty weird. Just as weird as the mangosteen. Lillian Min, freelance writer, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for us here on Press Play. We are not on Etsy, by the way, but you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want on Apple Podcasts or at kcrw.com/pressplay. And you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter at kcrwpressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.